live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. I welcome you. Today, we're going to learn about the latest on health and healing, how to live a longer life. Sorghum. Most people have never used it. It is now shown to be safe as a grain for people with celiac disease. The oil in coconut is really good for you. I'll explain why. New information on walnuts and how if you have walnuts each day, not a lot, you can have a significant drop in a particular disease. Also, that hormone that is secreted every night when we go to sleep called melatonin, new research on it. If you don't have enough of it, you're at serious risk for a very serious illness. And also, I'll tell you about a rice farmer who has 1,000% greater yield of organic rice than any of the GMOs have of their non-organic rice. My guest in the second part of our program, I'm giving a little extra time today because I feel the topic is important. I believe, based upon all the evidence at hand, that America is now a full-fledged police state. I believe that any form of dissent that threatens any governmental agency, politicians, a power, or any major corporation is viewed as an act of not just disobedience to the corporate state, but an act of terrorism. I believe that the militarization of local police departments have made them step over a line of, instead of looking out for and protecting the civilians under their care, have caused them to exploit those citizens, as we have seen. I also believe that the marriage between corporate power of the Business Roundtable, of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, working with all 50 of our state legislators, and that has created fascism in its most perfect and pure form. They virtually get an A-plus for what they've done because they have had a compliant and supplicant media, and this has allowed this to occur in a population that is indifferent. So today, continuing with our series on fascism in America, my guest will be John Whitehead. He is a constitutional attorney and human rights attorney, and he seeks to protect those who are persecuted and oppressed. He founded the Rutherford Institute, which is a nonprofit civil liberties and human rights organization, and we're going to talk about this. I will read you an article from John Whitehead, my guest, about the government's highway robbery, asset forfeiture, and the pillaging of the American people before we begin our comment with him. Also today, commentaries, my own, as well as Professor Henry Giroux. There's going to be an in-depth discussion on the militarization of all life and institutions. Also, time permitting, from Professor James Petras, legal imperialism on issues. Where are they now, the reporters who got everything wrong in Iraq? Peter Hart from FAIR.org. From the environmental segment, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, corporate power tool of the 1%. I'll be sharing you a short discussion on that from an article that was written by a group on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It'll be an interesting eye-opener. And withering drought plaguing half of the United States as we speak today. What does that really mean? When you live, as I do, on the Upper West Side, where our studios are here, and you walk down the street, you don't see the drought. You see prosperity. What does that do to the probably 50 or 60 million Americans living in oasis? They have everything. They have abundance. How does that disconnect them from the reality of those who are suffering, of the environment, of degradation, of imbalances? That'll be discussed if time permits. You can watch today's show by going to GaryNoll.com or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. On upcoming Earth Day, we will have some of the most vitalist thinkers on the relationship of the Earth to humans ever. Not the least of which will be Vandana Shiva, but the others will be equal in their capacity to share insights. When you see, and I will have some film footage of Vandana Shiva's farm, organic farm, at the base of the Himalayas in India, you'll see wonderful ways of growing food. Now, that is the old traditional way of growing food. But today, and for the past 50 years since the Green Revolution, that was sponsored principally by the Rockefeller Foundation and those corporations that saw a way of benefiting from it, most of the farmers are going towards genetically engineered organisms. Not a good idea. But for those who are challenging that, a very good idea. I'm a certified organic farmer. I grow crops organically. I'm a beekeeper. I have not experienced colony collapse. My bees are thriving. I have cherries 3 times a year from the same trees. I have figs 3 times a year. And when you realize that that wouldn't be possible without those bees and no sprays used and healthy fertilization. And as we speak right now, we are doing experimental sprouting. I'm trying to sprout in a way that has never been sprouted before. I'm photographing every stage, and when it's done, if successful, I will put it up on the web so you can all do it too. I believe in using anything we learn in a way to share as a public service. I'm also starting a new greenhouse, but this one I'm building myself, every single step. Now, I'm not there, but I was recently there, and it's all in motion, and it's all being time-lapse photographed. So you can build a greenhouse, a hydroponic greenhouse, in your own backyard, on the roof of your building, inexpensively, using natural and biodegradable materials. But I'm doing it both horizontally and vertically in a different way that's been done. And again, it's a way of getting greater crop yield, greater nutrient density in the foods that are grown, so you're actually healthier when you grow your own foods and eat them, tastier foods. And if it works, and we'll know shortly, about 60 days, then I'll put it all up on the web and share it free as a public service for you. And I'm doing it as a story with storyboards, so every single step will be explained in detail. So my passion for being close to the land and nurturing it in a way that we live in balance and not polluting it and letting the soil rest for a year and then building it up with seaweed. Yes, that would be me down at the ocean at 4 o'clock in the morning loading with a pitchfork seaweed into the back of a pickup truck and then letting that compost. And that becomes a very important part of the next generation of soil and microorganisms. In any case, when we look around the world, these techniques have been used for the millennia, and they're being reintroduced now. This is from Jonathan Benson of Natural News. An organic rice farmer in India yields over 22 tons of crop on only 2 acres, proving the fraud of GMOs and Big Agra. And despite all the claims made by industry-funded hacks that genetically modified organisms and other industrial agricultural methods are necessary for the future of humanity, it is the traditional growing methods that continue to shine through as the real sustainers of life. As reported by Gaia Health, Indian rice farmers using traditional organic growing methods are achieving yields far higher than farmers using more modern methods. In the case of Sumat Kumar, rice yields have surpassed the national average per hectare. A hectare, by the way, is 2.5 acres. nearly tenfold or 1,000%. That's according to the reports. And he yielded 22.4 tons of rice per hectare, greatly surpassing that of other rice farmers, currently outputting about 2.3 tons minus. Mind you, 2.3 using genetically engineered, 22.4 using organic. His secret? A traditional crop management protocol known as System of Root Intensification, or SRI. Now remember, if you were to take a carrot out of the ground, any carrot, you would see that there are lots of little tentacles. And these little tentacles are where the actual nutrients and minerals and water is absorbed into the tree or into the plant. And the soil has to have a certain looseness. If it's too compact, if it's too hard, if it's too rocky, then you don't have the ability to bring in as many nutrients. You want nice, soft soil, rich in nutrients. Black dirt is your best of all in the world. A volcanic soil is extremely important. And then this loose loamy soil is good. Clay is not good. Now you have to build on top of the clay. Otherwise, you get water resting on top of the clay, and that rots your roots. So the root of the soil is important. That's why, for example, I do raised bed. I'll raise a bed off the ground about 2 feet, 24 inches. And that means that as I'm planting in a raised bed, the roots can go deep. More minerals, greater irrigation, greater aeration, put worms in there. The worms go through the soil. They leave phosphorus and other nutrients in their wake. That's all picked up and brought in. It's simple. Well, this is very similar to what is done with the SRI. They're taking care of the root system. Now, the farmers adhering to SRI techniques will typically plant about half the number of seeds as farmers using more modern methods and will space them at intervals of about 10 inches. They also plant their seeds much younger and keep the soil drier while paying much more attention to the weed growth. And by hand removing weeds the old-fashioned way, the organic farmers are able to allow more water and nutrients to feed their rice plants, which results in significantly higher yields. This is from the agricultural minister, Dr. Sarsa, quote, "Farmers use less seeds, less water, and less chemicals, but they get more without having to invest more." This is revolutionary. I did not believe it to start with, but now I think it can potentially change the way everyone farms. I want every state to promote it. If we get 40% increase in yields, that is more than enough to recommend it. End quote. So the technique actually originated in Madagascar and was passed down generation to generation among villagers. And an agronomist by the name of Henry Delaney observed the methods back in the 1980s and brought them back into use. And he taught other farmers how to utilize them and with limited resources. And perhaps the greatest aspect of the SRI is that it's not tied to the biotechnology industry and big ag. So there is no buying of their seeds. So I'm very encouraged by this. I will be holding some webinar workshops in about 2 months from my home in Florida all over the world, and I'll show you new grafting techniques I've created to cross-pollinate fruits, ways of enhancing the nutrient density of vegetables, ways of growing your own microgreens that are extremely expensive. If you were to go down to the farmer's market at 17th Street Union Square, you'll find microgreens going for about $12 an ounce. An ounce. The cheapest I could find was $6 an ounce. And those are for tiny little things. Well, that's over $100 a pound. Yeah, and that's why you don't see it on restaurant menus. You may see it as a garnish, and you may see it in some of the very, very expensive restaurants, but otherwise you won't. Well, now I'll show you how to grow your own microgreens, which are extremely nutritious. They have far more vitamin C and phytonutrients than full-grown crops, and lots of enzymes for pennies. It's all in the technique. So I'll be letting you know when I'm going to do the webinar. It'll be free. It'll be as a public service to get people to grow more food and to remember, don't buy your organic food at Walmart. Boycott Walmart. Boycott every one of the 300-plus ALEC stores and corporations and products. Boycott the Whole Foods health food store because it's a part of the corporate mindset. It's exploited people and its own workers. Support local farmers markets. Support food co-ops like the one in Brooklyn and all around the Brooklyn, the High Foods Co-op and all the others. Support your local small health food store. But most importantly, start doing it yourself. Now, we know that we should get a good night's sleep. You know how you feel and how you look if you don't. But it gets worse. Because we tend to eat food before we go to bed at night, and we have food in our belly, and we don't like to sleep in the real dark, so there's always some kind of light in the background. And because a lot of people like to have some noise, believe it or not, a lot of people like to have a radio on when they go to sleep, or because people sleep with the television nearby, or an electrical digital clock nearby, or wires nearby their bed, all of which emanate electromagnetic pulses, all of that will affect your pineal gland, this tiny little grape seed-sized gland in the middle of your brain that secretes this very important hormone called melatonin. Now, when you've secreted adequate amounts of melatonin, it's a great antioxidant. It stimulates the immune system. It protects your body and your brain. It's just a superstar. But more often than not, when you wake up in the night and you turn the light on in your bathroom, the brightness of that light, again, the brightness of any light, once you've awakened, will then adversely affect melatonin being secreted. So, here is the latest, and this is from the Journal of the American Medical Association, and it was at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and it says the following. Decreased levels of the hormone melatonin may be linked to the development of type 2 diabetes. A study of U.S. women found that those with the lowest levels of melatonin had more than twice the risk of developing diabetes compared to women with the highest levels of melatonin. Now, here's my suggestion. If you are not sleeping ideally, and if you are not getting that deep rapid eye movement sleep, then take 1 to 3 milligrams of melatonin a night before you go to bed. Okay? One more reason to take omega-3 fatty acids from fish or from, as I do, from flaxseed and walnut. And those are the best because they both have high levels of DHA. This is from the Annals of Internal Medicine and from Harvard School of Public Health. High consumption of the omega-3 long-chain polyunsaturated fatty acids might be associated with a lower risk of dying among older adults by as much as 27%. Quote, our findings support the importance of adequate blood omega-3 levels for cardiovascular health and suggest that later in life, these benefits could actually extend the years of remaining life. Well, hello. We have an awful lot of people over the age of 40. We're approaching 100 million, nearly one-third of the American population. I think most of those people would like to reduce their risk of dying by 27%. So how about taking your omega-3 fatty acids? If you're older, twice a day, once in the morning and once nearly evening. And one last thing here, actually two, walnuts. I throw walnuts in salads. I throw them also into a smoothie each morning. And you can also throw pine nuts. or pignolias, and pistachios, raw, of course, and organic, or almonds, they're all good for you. But this specifically was on walnuts. A professor who, at Harvard School of Public Health, published in the Journal of Nutrition, walnuts linked to significant drop in diabetes risk. Quote, frequent consumption of walnuts could help slash the risk of type 2 diabetes by almost 25%. That's terrific, especially when this data came from 135,000 people studied over 10 years. So this is a major, major study. When you consider that we have between pre-diabetic and diabetic, nearly 100 million people who are in that range of diabetic conditions, you're talking about helping almost 25 million people who won't be suffering the same conditions like high blood pressure, heart disease, cancer, and depression. That's good news. And finally, two things that are really good for you. One is coconut oil. It's absolutely a must. But here is why. This is published in the peer-reviewed journal Neurobiology of Aging, and it says the medium-chain triglycerides found in coconut oil boost brain function in only one dose. How about that? That means one single teaspoon of coconut oil is going to help cognition, and that's just terrific. A single dose. Wow. And finally, sorghum, S-O-R-G-H-U-M, it's a grain, it's a cereal grain, and a lot of people who have celiac disease believe that, you know, since they have to avoid wheat and other grains, that they can't have it. But this study from the Journal of Agricultural and Food Chemistry says the following, that from the American Chemical Society, strong new biochemical evidence exists showing that the cereal grain sorghum is a safe food for people with celiac disease who must avoid other grains. The study, which includes molecular evidence that sorghum lacks the proteins toxic to people with celiac disease, is important. So that's good news, too. It allows people to have the benefits of sorghum. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to take a break and come back, and then it's commentary time. And I'm writing every night. I'm writing commentaries on important issues. According to the latest analytics that we receive, a substantial number of the people, especially younger people, appreciate the commentaries on these issues. And that's why we do commentaries, important and original guests, health and nutrition, and environmental issues. And there's something for everyone there. Also this Sunday, 9 o'clock, Central Park. And every Sunday now, we're going to start our marathon training group. That's 90th and 5th Avenue, 90th and 5th Avenue, 9 a.m. this Sunday. It's free, it's public service, and we're going to get you in great shape. You're going to be the best shape of your life. So I'll see you there. And also, for those of you who have not seen, which is most people, The Seeds of Death, the award-winning documentary, just won another award yesterday, a big one, the Houston International Film Festival Award, Best Documentary on Environmental Issues. I'll be screening it in New York City at the Theater for the New City. That's on April 30th, 7:30. That's down at 12th Street and 1st Avenue. It's a big theater, but we're always packed, so call to get a seat. 212-254-1109. 212-254-1109, and it's a $5 donation. Now, there'll be one final screening, and this is it, in Woodstock, at the Woodstock Community Center, screening Seeds of Death, Saturday, April 27, 7 p.m. For reservations, call 845-697-1025, 845-697-1025. Back in a moment. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Noll. We're broadcasting all over the world right now. I'm very concerned about the militarization of the corporate culture in the United States. Think of this for a moment. We have had, up to this point, almost 9 million homes that have been foreclosed on. We have another 6 million homes right now where they're underwater in their mortgages or late in their mortgage payments and are probably going to lose their homes. Yes, there are economies that are booming in the real estate market, including in New York City. Yesterday, I was out looking at some apartments, trying to find one of our employees a place that was affordable. I was just staggered by what little quality you get and how much they have to pay. And then you start finding out most people have their parents subsidizing them or someone else co-signing. And because it's a renter's market, or excuse me, it's a landlord's market with under 1% occupancy, vacancy, I should say, which means that it's harder and harder to find a place that you can afford. But that's in New York City. There are about 50 major real estate oases around the United States where the prices are going up, not down. But for the rest of America, they're going down and they're not coming back. And you have major ghettoization in the suburbs and urban areas where this is occurring. So here is the irony, and it's an irony that I believe we should really pay attention to. The people have had their homes repossessed by the very major banks like Bank of America and Citigroup that received in total over $16 trillion in zero interest loans from the Federal Reserve. And not only did they receive that money, but they could then take their bad assets, their bad bets, and wash them back through the Federal Reserve and make them go away. So if they made bad loans, all those disappear and they get fresh new money that they can go out and continue speculating, whether derivatives, buying up competition, enhancing the value of their stock to their stockholders. And yet, not a single bank forgave the loans, nor the debt, nor the interest on the debt. They could have done the right thing. So could have Congress. So could have the president. Could you imagine if the president had really cared about the people, including the very people that elected him, and said in a fireside chat, as FDR used to, is it right that these banks are able to get any amount of money they want, are too big to fail, and then instead of helping you spend the money on extending their bonuses and more of the vulture capitalism they've engaged in? Why couldn't they simply take your complete mortgage and bring it down to what the market is? So if you bought a house at $300,000 and the market now is $150,000, now your mortgage is $150,000. And if you had double-clicked up to 8%, they bring it down to 2%. And if you can't afford that, then they make an arrangement where you can spend 15% of your disposable income on rent to the bank until you're able to get up on your feet. Reasonable? Yes. Would we have displaced 40 million Americans from their homes? No. Would we have ghettoized neighborhoods and crime and other problems in those neighborhoods? No. But that would have meant that we would have had both a president, a Congress, a media, a banking institutions that cared about people first. But they don't. But then as if we're suffering from a massive illusion that these banks are really good, we keep our money in them. We get our credit cards from them. Is this the Stockholm Syndrome, where we begin to be empathetic with our jailers? This is a part of this militarization, and I'm very concerned about it. How does one account for the lack of public outcry over millions of Americans losing their homes because of corrupt banking practices, and millions more becoming unemployed because of the lack of an adequate jobs program in the United States? While at the same time, stories abound of colossal greed and corruption on Wall Street. For example, in 2009 alone, hedge fund manager David Tepper made approximately $4 billion. As Michael Yates points out, this income, spent at the rate of $10,000 a day, and exclusive any interest would last him for 1,096 years. But let's make it simpler to understand. Let's say that Mr. Tepper worked 2,000 hours in a year. That's a 40-hour week for 50 weeks. He would earn $2 million an hour and $30,000 a minute. Now, juxtaposition that with robber baron power and greed to mainstream living and the deep suffering and misery now experienced by over 240 million Americans. The workers, the children, the jobless public servants, and young people. This is especially true of a generation of youth who have become the new zero generation, relegated to zones of social and economic abandonment and marked by zero jobs and zero future and zero hope. Narcissism and unchecked greed have morphed into more than a psychological category that points to a character flaw among a marginal few. Such registers are now symptomatic of a market-driven society in which extremes of violence, militarization, cruelty, and inequality are hardly noticed and have become normalized. Avarice and narcissism are not new. What is new is the unprecedented social sanction of the ethos of greed that has emerged since the 1980s. What is also new is that military force and values have become a source of pride rather than alarm in American society. Not only has the war on terror violated a host of civil liberties, it has further sanctioned a military that has assumed a central role in American society, influencing everything from markets and education to popular culture and fashion. Was it not President Dwight Eisenhower, when he left office, warning about the rise of military-industrial complex with a pernicious alignment of the defense industry, the military and political power altogether? What he understood was the transition from a militarized economy to a militarized society in which the culture itself was shaped by military power and values and interest. And what has become clear in contemporary America is that the organization of civil society for the production of violence is more than producing militarized technologies and weapons. It is also about producing militarized subjects in a permanent war economy. As Aaron O'Connell points out, our culture has militarized considerably since Eisenhower era, with civilians, not the armed services, being the principal cause. How often have we heard our lawmakers and pundits say, support our troops to justify defense spending, to TV programs and video games like NCIS and Homeland and Call of Duty, to NBC's shameful and unreal reality show Stars Earn Stripes? Americans are subjected to daily diet of stories that valorize the military while the storytellers pursue their own opportunistic political and commercial agendas. The imagery of war and violence informs every aspect of American society and extends from the celebration of a warrior culture in mainstream media to the use of universities to educate students in the logic of the national security state. Military deployments now protect free trade arrangements, provide job programs, and drain revenue from public accounts. For instance, Lockheed Martin stands to gain billions of dollars in profits as Washington prepares to buy 2,443 F-35 fighter planes at a cost of $90 billion each for the company. The overall cost to taxpayers for a plane that has been called a $1 trillion boondoggle expects to cost tremendous amount, probably closer to $2 trillion. What could $2 trillion do for the American economy? Well, A, it could rebuild all of our infrastructure, our dikes, our dams, our rivers that are need a cleansing, like the Mississippi. It needs to be detoxified. It needs to be dredged. What about our aquifers, our gas lines? What about our schools and our crumbling cities and bridges? What about de-ghettoizing America by putting a works program, educational program in every ghetto, and take back the land, take back the buildings for the citizens there? That's what it could do. It could start a whole new concept of homesteading, allowing people 100 acres of land free if they farm it organically and provide 25% of their crop yield to local community food banks. Think of what that could do. A universal health care system. So much for so many. Renewal of the culture wars has resulted in a Republican Party which is now considered the party of anti-science. Similar, many people in the media and talk show hosts and other pundits loudly and widely spread the message that a culture of questioning anything is antithetical to the American way. So those of us who speak up, any individual that speaks up today is considered un-American, unpatriotic. If you're not for their wars, you're against America, they say. No, we're very much for America, but America of ethics, America of morals, America of spiritual values, America of conscience. Not America, the military-industrial complex. That I will not support. And yet, we are deemed unpatriotic for that. There is a machine at work. It is a machine that does not stop 24/7. It is more powerful than every think tank, liberal or conservative, and provides ample funds for training and promoting anti-public pseudo-intellectuals, religious fundamentalists, while simultaneously offering policy statements and talking points to Fox News and others. This very growing information illiteracy bubble has become a powerful force of a public response. The public learns not from critical thinkers, honest thinkers, independent thinkers. It learns from ideologues. It learns on the war on science, but reason and critical thought are not taught. So let us think, was it not John Acheson who pointed out that we are witnessing an epical shift in our social, political world? We are de-evolving. We're hurtling headlong, as he said, into a past that was defined by serfs and lords, by superstition, by policies based upon fiat, not facts. We are also plunging into a dark world of anti-intellectualism, civic illiteracy, and a formative culture supportive of an authoritarian state. The embrace of ignorance is at the center of political life today, and a reactionary form of public power has become the most powerful element of the politics of authoritarianism. Civic illiteracy is the modus operandi for creating depoliticized subjects who believe that consumerism is the only obligation of citizenship, who privilege opinions over reasoned arguments, and who are led to believe that ignorance is a virtue rather than a political and civic liability. In any educated democracy, much of the debate that occupies political life today extends from creationism and climate change denial and education that is without empowering the learner. And in conclusion, was it not James Baldwin's open letter to my sister Angela Davis, in which he points out that we live in an age in which silence is not only criminal, but suicidal? The imagery is also on full display in Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from Birmingham City Jail, where King states, under the weight and harshness of incarceration, that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, and asks whether we will be extremists for the preservation of injustice or will be extremists for the cause of justice. According to King, he said we must use time creatively and forever realize that the time is always right to do right. Now is the time to make real the promise of democracy. We hear it in the words of former Harvard University President James Conant, who makes an impassioned call for the need for the American radical, the missing political link between the past and future of this great democratic land, he said. We hear it in the voices of the young across our country, the new American radicals, who call for fighting for a society in which justice matters, social protections are guaranteed, equality is ensured, and education becomes a right and not an entitlement. The radical imagination waits to be unleashed through social movements in which injustice is put on the run in civil literacy, economic justice, collective struggle. Once again becomes the precondition of agency, hope, and struggle over democracy. Let us welcome my guest, who is standing by to our program, John Whitehead. Nice to have you with us today, John.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
John is the attorney who founded the Rutherford Institute, a nonprofit civil liberties and human rights organization down in Charlottesville, Virginia. He is here to talk about the many policies and indications that the U.S. is turning into a police state, and we welcome him. John, you wrote an article. It was called "The Governmental Highway Robbery, Asset Forfeiture, and the Pillaging of the American People." It was published, I'm not sure, I don't have the citation there, but it was very important. Would you please begin by talking about the kind of go-with-the-flow conversation in America, the use of drones for domestic policing and surveillance, the rapid increase in SWAT team raids over the years, the rapid increase in deployment of surveillance technology, the extinguishing of free speech? Let's begin with those, please.
Yeah, you know, I write a weekly commentary on all these subjects. People should go to Rutherford.org and read the commentaries. You'll get an idea of where we're headed, but it's all culminating in a book that I got coming out in June. It's called A Government of Wolves. It's after the Edward R. Murrow quote. You remember Edward R. Murrow fought during the McCarthy era? He had a great quote where he said, "A nation of sheep begets a government of wolves." And that's basically what we become. You know, what you were saying before I came on the air is absolutely correct. People now basically are ignorant, especially about their civil liberties. I'm a constitutional attorney. I've been practicing in this area almost 40 years. I have a summer intern program, just to give you an example, where law students come study with me every summer. This is its 30th year. In the 30 years that I have done the program, when the students come in, I usually interview them, go over their resume, but the one question I ask them is, can you give me the five freedoms in the First Amendment? Let me reiterate, these are law students. I have yet to find one who can do that. So what's happened, and I've talked to civics educators in high school and otherwise, we're not teaching rights anymore. Kids have no idea what's in the Bill of Rights. Very, very uneducated in their civil liberties. They don't know what's in the First Amendment or the Fourth Amendment, which really is the amendment that protects us from becoming a police state against unreasonable searches and seizures. So we basically, and adults are worse, by the way. Most adults I talk to, when I've asked them, have you ever read the Constitution? They look at me like I'm from outer space. So what's happened over many years, the educational system has let us down. A number of the things you're talking about, the strong corporate military-industrial complex, all the things that we've been doing overseas in the last 15 to 20, 30 years, they're coming home. When we see kids tasered now, or old ladies tasered by the police now, tasers were first practiced and used overseas. They were brought home because the police can make a lot of money off of them. The corporations selling them can make a lot of money. Now in 2015, drones are going to start flying over the United States. They're saying now, the experts say, about 30,000 by 2020. The drones that will be flying in the United States will be equipped with weapons, rubber bullets, sound cannons, all the things that have been used overseas, and they're going to be quite dangerous, in my opinion. There are going to be some good uses for drones, and the drone debate's been real big lately. And I started writing on drones 2 years ago because I saw what was coming. In fact, I proposed a drone law here, and our local city council passed it. It was the first in the United States a month ago. And since then, several state legislatures are moving in that direction. But so what you're saying is absolutely correct. We are moving in that, what I would consider, I would say this, and most of my friends have been working with me for a number of years, including Nat Hinhoff out of New York and across the country, civil libertarians. We're in a police state already. The question is, how deep is it, and can we get out? So that's sort of the overview I would give people. But the thing I think you said that strikes me most, ignorance has become sort of a virtue. We're trained to be consumers, and that in the end, what you're going to find, most people are going to find when they come knocking at your door, and they won't be knocking because there's 80,000 SWAT team raids across the country each year, most of them for misdemeanor services, most of them for marijuana. Someone smoking a marijuana, having some marijuana in their home, where kids are getting are slammed to the ground, dogs are shot. There was a case of Jose Guerana in 2011 in Arizona, a mistaken SWAT team raid in a man's home. He was a former Iraqi war veteran. He told his kids to get in the closet. It was 3 a.m. in the morning. The police came to his door. They shot him 50-some times, left him on the front lawn to bleed to death. This is a decorated vet. And come to find out there was no marijuana in the home, they made a mistake. That's what we're seeing happening across the country. The media very seldom even reports that these things are happening. One thing that scares me, if I can just finish, the media's lack of concentration on these issues is frightening.
But it's intentional.
I think it's either intentional. I don't know that for sure, but it seems like how can you avoid doing stories on SWAT team raids if it wasn't intentional? Yeah, so I think you make a good point.
John, I would like to read now for our audience some of this article, because I think it will explain so much of what you are concerned with and why they should be concerned. All right? Quote, this is...
Yep.
Okay, I'm... long before Americans chartered their revolutionary course in pursuit of happiness, it was life, liberty, and property, which constituted the golden triad of essential rights that the government was charged with respecting and protecting. To the colonists smarting from mistreatment at the hands of the British Crown, protecting their property from the governmental abuse was just as critical as preserving their lives and liberties. As the colonists understood, if the government can arbitrarily take away your property, you have no true rights. You're nothing more than a serf or a slave. The Fifth Amendment to the Constitution was born of this need to safeguard against any attempt by the government to unlawfully deprive a citizen of the right to life, liberty, and property without due process of law. Little could our ancestral forebears have imagined that it would take less than 3 centuries of so-called independence to once again render us browbeaten subjects in bondage to an overlord bent on depriving us of our most inalienable and fundamental rights. The latest government scheme to deprive Americans of their liberties, namely the right to property, is being carried out under the guise of civil asset forfeiture, a government practice wherein government agents, usually the police, seize private property they suspect may be connected with criminal activity. Then, and here's the kicker, whether or not any crime is actually proven to have taken place, the government keeps the citizen's property, often divvying up with the local police who did the initial seizure. For example, the federal government recently attempted to confiscate Russell Caswell's family-owned Massachusetts motel, insisting that because a small percentage of the motel's guests had been arrested for drug crimes, 15 out of 200,000 visitors, again, 15 out of 200,000 visitors over a 14-year span, the motel was a quote, dangerous property. This cruel surprise was engineered by Vincent Kelly, a forfeiture specialist at the Drug Enforcement Administration, who read about the motel in a news report and found that the property, which the Caswells owned free and clear, had an assessed value of $1.3 million. So Kelly approached the local police department with an equitable sharing deal. The feds would seize the property and sell it, and the cops could get up to 80% of the proceeds. Thankfully, with the help of a federal judge, Caswell managed to keep his hotel. Now, some states actually are considering expanding the use of asset forfeiture laws to include petty misdemeanors. This would mean that property could be seized in cases of minor crimes such as harassment or possessions of small amounts of marijuana or even trespassing in a public park after dark. As the Institute of Justice points out, civil forfeiture laws represent one of the most serious assaults on private property rights in the nation today. Under civil forfeiture, police and prosecutors can seize your car or other property, sell it, and use the proceeds to fund agency budgets, all without as much as charging you with a crime. Unlike criminal forfeiture, where property is taken after the owner has been found guilty in a court of law, civil forfeiture, owners need not be charged with or convicted of a crime to lose homes, cars, cash, or other property. Americans are supposed to be innocent until proven guilty, but civil forfeiture turns that principle on its head. With civil forfeiture, you're guilty and your property seized, and relying on a topsy-turvy legal theory that one's property can not only be guilty of a crime, but is guilty until proven innocent, government agencies have eagerly cashed in on this revenue scheme, often under the pretext of war on drugs, by asserting that someone's personal property, a building, a large amount of cash, for example, is tied to illegal activity. The government, usually the police, then confiscate the property for its own uses, and it's up to the property owner to try to jump through legal loopholes to prove that the property was obtained legally. Despite the fact that 80% of these asset forfeiture cases result in no charge against property owner, challenging these takings in court can cost the owner more than the value of the confiscated property itself. As a result, most property owners either give up the fight or chalk the confiscation up to government corruption, leaving the police and other government agencies to reap the benefits. For example, under the Federal Equitable Sharing Program, police turn cases over to federal agents who process seizures and then return 80% of the proceeds to the police. And so it goes. It was $4.2 billion last year. And when I read the rest of the story, and that's all we have time for, it's scary. Now, back to you, John. John, this would mean that if they wanted anything from you, all they have to do is... If they brought a dog in one case and the dog barked, there was no drugs when some money that a person was taking to buy a home, but the dog barked, so they kept it based upon the idea that the dog barked. And if the dog barked, then the dog must have sensed something, even if there's nothing there, and they kept the guy's money. This is just insane.
Yep.
But how bad is this, and why are the average Americans not paying attention to how easy this could be to victimize them, take their cars, take their homes, take their businesses from them?
Well, the thing we talked about earlier, it's not publicized. Most people have no clue this is happening. That's why I wrote on it. When I would mention it to people, they'd look at me and go, oh, you're kidding. No. So you read a large portion of my commentary, but what it says is that if they want your property and you're, again, you said the dog barks. That's the case of Jerome Chenault, who was on his way across country to buy a home. He had some cash in his car, and they used the dogs. They walk around the car, the police, and the dog supposedly alerted to the box of cash he had in his car. He had done nothing wrong, by the way. Well, then they confiscated, his property, his car. And the thing in these cases is that you have to go in and fight for it. They don't pay the legal expenses. And like you said, a lot of people give up. The thing also about the dogs, and I've written on that, the police dogs, the leading study shows they're 80% wrong most of the time. So that's just an illusion, the police use to another illusion they can use to get your property or drag you into some kind of situation in a courtroom where you shouldn't belong.
John, what can we do as citizens to push back and stop this?
Well, the first thing I say to people is this. If education precedes action, first of all, again, we have a pamphlet I hand out free to people. It's called Do You Know the Bill of Rights? If your listeners want it, great. People actually go home and teach their kids with our little pamphlet. The first thing is to know you have rights. The second thing is, again, you mentioned Martin Luther King was my hero. I love the way he had the guts to stand up to people. And what I tell people, if you don't have the intestinal fortitude to stand up on these things, find somebody, some leader in your community that does. And you probably, if you look, you'll find that person. The other thing I tell people is that act locally, think nationally. You can make progress on the local level if you get organized. You can change some of the crazy laws, asset forfeiture, which you just talked about. You can fight that locally. Nationally, as we know, it's very, very difficult to make very much of an impact in Washington, D.C. But again, if you don't know your rights, you're not going to get anywhere anyway. Go down to your local public school and ask them what in the world. Get you a committee, an education committee. Get together with your neighbors. Go down and ask why they're not teaching the Bill of Rights anymore at public schools.
John,
why do your children not know what's in the First Amendment? So it's going to take citizen activism. Just like when you're talking about the colonists, they were activists. Modern Americans sit and watch TV, and as I tell people, television is an instrument of compliance. It's there to make you sit and watch and not do anything.
John Whitehead, the Rutherford.org is the website, RUTHERFORD.org. You're doing great work for all of us, and I appreciate it. We look forward to another conversation.
Thank you, sir.
John Whitehead, on the topic of the police and indications of the U.S. turning into a police state. There'll be a lot more programs on this topic. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Now let's take a moment for talk back. We have a few moments. 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. First up, Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Well, as fate would have it, I have an article here from one of your listeners who is very, very concerned. There is actually, this is coming from Chuck Schumer and Lindsey Graham, two senators, and this is what's happening. They're vouching for a biometric national ID card that would force workers to submit a fingerprint, hand, or iris scan. And any worker failing to comply with this biometric tracking mandate would be terminated from their job. It's called the Believe system. So the question becomes, what if freedom-loving Americans don't want their hands or eyes scanned? In a free country, no one should be required to submit their body to such control. And yet we're already doing this when if we have to take a flight. So you have listeners that are incensed by this. It's not about, I mean, it's supposed to be to control illegal immigrants from getting jobs. And yet, really, it's all about control. And it's the real fight is going to be preventing the government from controlling and monitoring Americans' every move. And, of course, they want your input on this.
I'm opposed to any form of metric system that the biometrics that is able to hold and then share all of the data on you. I'm opposed to any form of identification card as such, because once they have it, here's what you didn't mention that could happen. They could prevent you from buying things in stores, from traveling on airplanes, planes, buses, because then it's only one step from having everyone ID'd then to having a electronic currency only that the banks control, so that you can't purchase anything, you can't travel anywhere unless you're under constant monitoring or they could stop you. And that's what I'm concerned about. And all of our politicians in Washington are in my opinion, beneath contempt. So I wouldn't trust any politician at this moment, any of them. Okay? Thank you. And Tom, you're the last call up today from Bronx.
Hi, Gary. I'd like to say that the next best product to honey, in my opinion, is molasses. And the plant is self-pollinating. It's sexual. That would, in other words, it doesn't need the buzz of the bee.
Well, you have to understand that molasses is better than any of the refined sugars because the dark color are the minerals, but it would have to take a second seat to a raw honey. It'd be raw honey, then molasses, but still good. Thanks for your call. Let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today it is... Oh, by the way, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Great. We're talking, today's open forum where everybody gets to put their ideas forward and, of course, prepared themselves to be challenged with love and respect, of course.
Good.
But today's open forum on Lead Stories.
We look forward to it. In a moment, Utrice Lead.